This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The fatal shooting of an Orlando police officer and the death of an Orange County sheriff's deputy comes at a time when law enforcement fatalities are rising. Master Sergeant Deborah Clayton was fatally shot trying to make contact with homicide suspect Markeith Lloyd, and Deputy First Class Norman Lewis died in a traffic accident while searching for Lloyd. According to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, 135 officers died nationwide in 2016. That's up from 123 the year before. Well, joining me is the president of the Florida Police Chiefs Association, Butch Arenal. He's the chief of police in Coconut Creek. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Matthew. Thank you.
Well, first of all, a reaction to the deaths of these two Orlando law enforcement officers. We've seen an outpouring of support from the community. Give me the police perspective. What's it like for a department or a sheriff's office when this happens?
Well, it's a tragedy, and we just happened to be opening our statewide conference on the morning that this occurred. Chief Mina was supposed to be with us from Orlando and had his honor guard there and everyone, and it was Law Enforcement Appreciation Day. And anytime a law enforcement officer dies in the line of duty, it affects every one of us across the country. That includes all 900,000 law enforcement officers that exist across the country. But it's tragic, and we are all quite impatient for this suspect to be apprehended safely.
I guess the flip side of that is, as Chief Mina himself pointed out, policing is a dangerous job. You know, he was asked, should there be a change in policy? And he said that Master Sergeant Deborah Clayton did everything that he would have done in that situation. He pointed out she was wearing body armor, and obviously a tragedy, but he said policing is dangerous.
Yes, it's a whole new world in policing. And this is complicated by the fact that for many, many years, many of us have been trying to alter the perspective of policing, in that while we all have engaged in community policing, the vast majority of us have engaged in what we call good to great policing, which is trying to integrate the paramilitary police management style with a business philosophy. And doing that is extremely difficult when you have a toxic environment with police, because we have a much younger officer now. The new millennials are different, and there is somewhat of a siege mentality upon them, and that their safety is at jeopardy every day. So we're doing everything we can to work through this and to keep our community safe at the same time.
Can you unpack that a little bit when you say it's a toxic environment? I mean, what exactly do you mean by that?
Well, when I first arrived at Coconut Creek a little over a year ago, I met with each member of my police department. And one of the questions I asked them was, what is the number one problem you see facing our department today? And the response from these officers was perception of the public of police in general. So at a time in which we are trying to promote community orientation and trying to promote an era of treating our communities as customers and trying to provide quality customer service, they are being killed or injured at disproportionate numbers. I mean, we've annually, based on the President's 21st Century Policing Report, had right around 100,000 injuries a year. That's over a tenth of our police officer population.
So do you think community policing is still valid, Chief Arenal? I mean, and when you look at this particular case with Master Sergeant Clayton and Sheriff's Deputy Norm Lewis, both of these pretty well plugged into the community, Deborah Clayton especially really active with the youth groups, with the kids and the community she was policing. And does that work, or do you think there needs to be a rethinking of that approach?
No, it absolutely works. Master Sergeant Clayton, she's a special person. There's no question about that. And she was doing her job. She happened upon a homicide suspect. And while many of the deaths we're now facing, and I mean, it's tragic to say, but now a concern of our police officers is ambush attacks. Let's face it. And this officer attempted to engage this person that may have been a suspect in a crime, and now we know he was. She was just tragically gunned down. But we live in an era, Matthew, where We are now contemplating, you know, purchasing devices for our officers' cars that can protect against ambushes, that can alert you when people approach your vehicle from different directions. It's a terrible environment to be in when you're attempting to promote and work towards, working closely with your community. And at the same time, we're trying to provide our officers with all the equipment we can. And there's a lot, and it's not cheap to keep them as safe as possible while they're out there.
And I wonder if you could put the deaths of law enforcement officers nationwide last year in context, because although that number did go up by about some 10%, I believe, it is still down from when it was at something like 177 back in 2011. So were officer fatalities trending down up until last year?
Well, they were from 14 to 15 only. But what I think is the important factor is that in 2016, we had more gunfire deaths than all the way back. I mean, they doubled in gunfire deaths from 2013. Many of this, which were publicized, were ambush attacks on law enforcement officers. And so there are going to be deaths, and we never accept any of our law enforcement officers, but there will be car crashes, things inherent to the nature of police work. But when 63, 64 of your officers in a given year die by gunfire, that is an alarming trend.
Is there a chilling effect too? You talk about young officers, millennial officers, the new breed of police. When they see things like this happening, does it make them think twice about signing up for this job?
Well, certainly it does, and we've seen that effect in our recruiting and hiring. I know that our last posting for a job in the state, we got about half the applicants that we normally get. And this is at a time in which we are working harder than ever to attract the best of the best. And it has definitely had an effect. And I'm sure you've heard the term Ferguson effect, relating from the August shooting of Michael Brown. I will tell you, I believe in it. I have looked at the data from all angles. And there is no doubt in my mind that our police officers are oftentimes on the defensive out there at a time in which we are trying to get them to get out and immerse themselves in the community. And amongst many of our law enforcement officers, there's just simply a feeling that no matter what they do and no matter how they do it in a violent engagement, there is kind of a no-win scenario. They're going to be reviewed by a grand jury, and we've even seen law enforcement officers die because of hesitation, and it's counter to the training that they receive when it comes to protecting themselves. So it is a toxic environment, and that is why we call for our national political leaders not to divide the community and police officers by feeding this divide, but by simply speaking out on behalf of these law enforcement officers that are doing the best they can across this country with very, very good results in crime reduction. But it's our job as chiefs to make sure they go home safe every day and every night. And when we lose one, we as chiefs, we as sheriffs, we feel some level of ownership, no matter how the officer loses their life. It's a tragedy, and it should be viewed as such.
I wonder, though, Chief Arenal, if there's a danger in kind of putting those two things together. When you talk about the Ferguson effect, and there have been a lot of protests in the last 12 to 24 months, folks who are upset about police brutality in their communities. And as you point out, police are taking steps to try and right that situation through community policing. And you are seeing, too, that people who are protesting against police brutality, they're coming out and saying, look, violence against police isn't acceptable either. So is it an oversimplification to say that we're looking at the Ferguson, quote-unquote Ferguson effect here, and that police officers, makes it more difficult for police officers to do their jobs?
No one finds police misconduct more reprehensible than law enforcement leaders. However, we take responsibility. I've got 140 people working for me in my agency, 101 of which are sworn. I take full and total responsibility for everything each and one of my officers does day in and day out. That's part of my job. I also expect other leaders of groups, I expect other leaders that may have a certain agenda to take responsibility for what their organizations do. And you know as well as I do, there have been people calling out for deaths of police officers that have been attacking this profession. And we make, Matthew, we make 12 and a half million arrests every year. 12 and a half million with, and that averages out to about 34,000 arrests each day. The vast majority, 99.9, you never hear about. There are going to be circumstances that have to be investigated. And there are going to be situations where there is a mistake or there may be misconduct. And we pride ourselves on handling those situations, and they're going to occur. But the backlash against police in general is creating a dangerous environment for our police officers out there.
Just picking up from what you were saying about the dangerous environment that police find themselves in now and the difficulty of policing and I guess the atmosphere of protest that, you know, you mentioned Ferguson, there have been other instances too, but I'm wondering if it's entirely fair to lay the blame of, for example, calls for police killings at the feet of people who are peacefully protesting. I mean, is it fair to paint every protester with the same brush and say that it's all kind of tied together?
No, absolutely not. And I certainly didn't do that. We are the greatest supporters of peaceful protest and always have been. It just is in recent times we're dealing with protests in which protesters are carrying rifles over their shoulders. They're more militant. Many have called for the death of police officers. And all we're saying is that we expect our political leadership, and I say this as a representative of the third largest chiefs association in the country, to be vocal and outspoken in their support of the importance of protection of our law enforcement officers. And nothing good comes out of, threatening law enforcement officers. Peaceful protest is one thing, but we have not seen a lot of that in these larger incidents around the country. We've seen quite violent protests and destruction of property and things of that nature. So 100% in agreement with you that peaceful protest is the way to go if you have an issue, as long as it is that.
Butch Arenal, some final thoughts then on the Orlando Police Department and the Orange County Sheriff's Office as they contemplate the road ahead after what's been a tragic week for them.
Well, I will tell you on behalf of our almost 1,000 members of our association, I just want to convey to Chief Mina, who is just an amazing law enforcement leader, and to Sheriff Demings, our heartfelt condolences for what they are going through right now. They're not just searching for a very, very dangerous and violent perpetrator. They're also having to deal with the pain and anguish of losing a police officer, and both of them. So our condolences go out to them, and we pray that this suspect is taken into custody sooner than later without anyone, and that includes law enforcement or civilians, being hurt. And we just ask the community to do everything you can to help us apprehend this individual without further loss of life.
Butch Arenal is the president of the Florida Police Chiefs Association. He joined us from Coconut Creek. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Matthew.
Still to come, Senator Bob Graham says the poor state of civics education may be partly to blame for American voters' lack of engagement in politics. Graham and Chris Hand have written a book to encourage citizens to participate in democracy. We'll talk to them when Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. America, the Owner's Manual, subtitled You Can Fight City Hall and Win, was co-authored by Chris Hand and Senator Bob Graham. I want to thank you both for joining me.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, this book encourages citizens to get active in government. Senator Graham, talk to me about the state of civics and involvement in government by citizens today. What's your impression?
My impression is that we've almost lost 50 years. We stopped teaching civics in the United States in about the 1970s. We've had two generations of Americans who have gone through the formal education process without much exposure to what it means to be a citizen in a democracy. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we think has been lost in that process is the idea that you don't have to depend upon your elected public official as the only way you can influence government. You, as a citizen, have rights and responsibilities that allow you to be very engaged in the kind of government which you seek for your community, your state, or for the nation. Our book, America, the Owner's Manual, is a guide to how to maneuver that process and not only be engaged, but be effectively engaged, accomplish your objective, fight City Hall, mm-hmm. and win. The book is divided into 10 chapters, each of which is devoted to a particular skill of citizenship. We have numerous case studies of how citizens have used their skill either to reduce the level of drunk driving, to increase the use of solar energy to solve a social problem at a college campus. We also have tips from the pros, which are short essays, including one by the former news director of this station on how to, in her case, use radio as a means of reaching a larger audience. Mm-hmm. And then we have the baseline text, which provides step-by-step recommendations of how to create a coalition, raise the money necessary to fund your cause, or the other essential steps of effective citizenship.
Chris Hann, if Senator Graham saying that civics hasn't been taught in school since the 70s, what was your first experience of civics, whether educational or practical experience?
Well, I had the very good fortune to work for Bob Graham in the United States Senate for 5 years, almost 5 years. So that's a civics education in itself. But he's right. In public schools here in Florida, when I was growing up, and I'm from Jacksonville, I grew up in Duval County, Florida. When I was growing up, all the government classes that were taken were usually by choice because you wanted to, as an elective or an advanced placement course. There were some basic required courses. But as Senator Graham and I talk about, the problem isn't just that civics isn't required teaching. It's how it's taught. Many times when civics is taught in schools, it's taught as a spectator sport. How you would kind of watch and observe the arena of the game and the arena of democracy being played out. Mm-hmm. It generally hasn't taught as a participatory sport. How do you get in the arena and use the skills of effective citizenship to move government in your direction? So it's not just a question of needing to teach mm-hmm. it more. It's a question of teaching it differently as well.
But people are getting involved, right? I mean, we are seeing people, whether it's by the simple fact of getting out at a rally or something or contacting their local lawmakers, people are still, I think, plugged in on some level to government.
Well, I think people are plugged in on some level, but I think you've seen the tremendous level of cynicism and discouragement that exists out there. Mm-hmm. At the end of 2015, the Pew Charitable Trust did a survey and found that 74% of Americans believe that government no longer listens to them. A year ago, in January of 2016, the RAND Corporation surveyed likely Republican voters and found that asking them about different issues on which they might base their vote, those who said, "I'm voting because government no longer listens to me," 86.5% chose Donald Trump as their likely opponent. So there's a massive amount of
opponent.
As the candidate they supported.
Right.
So there's a massive amount of Americans out there right now who are cynical about government, who don't believe government listens to them. Our book is a prescription to helping people make government listen to them and respond to their hopes and concerns.
Senator Graham, let me just come back to the preface of the book. You write that voters responded to the, quote, bombastic rhetoric and vitriolic tone of the 2016 campaign, suggesting a serious lack of confidence in American political leaders and institutions. But I think a lot of people were turned off by the tone of the campaign as well. So how do you balance those two competing forces?
Well, there were a lot of Americans turned off, and therefore only 74% of the people who were eligible to vote, even in such an important and high-visibility campaign as we've just experienced, actually exercised their right to vote. So I think that this campaign has maybe, and I hope, will be a pivotal time that people will begin to ask, if I can't accomplish my objectives through the people I elect, if I use my vote more as a protest to government for failing to listen to people like me, hopefully the result will be more citizens will see it as their opportunity, their challenge, to identify problems in their community or their state that they would like to change, and to acquire the passion, the skills, and the persistence to see those issues through to a different end result, which is the one that the citizens sought.
Senator Graham, a lot's been written and talked about in the 2016 election, but I'm wondering, if you look back on previous elections, whether presidential or otherwise, is there something you can compare it to, or does it seem like a brand new era of politics for good or ill?
It's hard to think of a presidential election that had the characteristics of 2016. We've had very contentious presidential elections going back to 1800, when two of our founding fathers, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, almost got into fistfights over the election. But the combination of a electorate which generally was not as informed about some of the basic principles of government. One of the candidates, I'll not name which, would stand up and say, the first day I'm in office, I'm going to do laundry list of things. Well, the fact is, the president of the United States is not George III. He's not king. He has to operate within a Republican system of government where other people share and even counter the president's power.
Part of our message in this book is citizens don't have to live vicariously through elected officials. Elections are not the only means through which to express your hopes and concerns and, you know, hope that they'll be carried out over time. The reason we present the 10 skills of effective citizenship is so that Americans can be engaging with government even when elections aren't going on, using these 10 skills and the lessons learned from other citizens who have come before them to make government respond. So it's not just about being involved in election time. There's no question that's the most fundamental aspect of our democracy. But anyone who puts all of their hopes and dreams in a particular candidate or a particular vote is probably going to end up disappointed. The fact of the matter is, we have all the skills we need to build and flex our citizenship muscles and make government respond.
Let me ask, too, about this idea of awareness of the electoral process or just how the political process works exactly. And for example, look at the interest in the Electoral College by voters after the election, either people wanting to know exactly what it is or complaining about it. Chris Hand, is that a good thing, this sort of spike in interest in this particular process of American elections?
Well, it's always a good thing when people sort of seek to learn more about the governmental process that we have and make suggestions on how it might be changed. But again, knowledge is only the first step. Knowledge gives you the necessary skills you need to be a good spectator. It's taking that next step and using the skills of effective participatory involvement in government that is so important. So I think it's always a wonderful thing when people have knowledge, but what's more important is having the skills to turn knowledge into action.
Mm-hmm. Senator Graham, what do you think about the debate over fake news?
One of the responsibilities of a good citizen is to be able to listen to news, to understand and challenge the sources from which that piece of information came, and form an opinion as to whether the information is credible. I think what's changed is that there are so many channels through which news, real or fake, can now be transmitted. When I was a younger man, basically you depended upon three television networks, your local newspaper, maybe an occasional magazine, mm-hmm. As your source of information. And there was a lot of confidence that those entities were under the control of responsible people who were using them for the appropriate purpose of educating the American people so that the people could make an independent judgment as to what it all meant. This phenomenon of using fake news is a relatively new one, and I think has been sparked by the fact that instead of three networks, we've now got hundreds of television and radio channels of information. And we have, through social media, the ability of almost anyone to present themselves as being the Walter Cronkite of America today.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a serious issue, and it's one that I think particularly is going to challenge our educational institutions to rethink what makes an appropriate civic curriculum. We now are dealing with such a small amount of civics that it almost doesn't make any difference. But what we do have doesn't engage citizens and require them to use their mental abilities to do critical thinking to try to sort chaff from wheat in terms of what is reality and what is not.
You mentioned that the plethora of sources of information, some of them credible, some of them not so much. I mean, we're in the Twitter age now. What's your advice? Do you think people should just unplug from some of the stuff?
No, I don't think they should unplug. I think they should use the means of communication that are available to them. It has substantially increased the capability of citizens to be actively engaged and make a difference. But there also is a responsibility that comes with that additional set of opportunities to use it in a manner that is truthful to the persons with whom you are attempting to communicate,
mm-hmm.
And that you are prepared to place your reputation behind what you are broadcasting to the world.
Chris Hand, let me ask about the previous edition of this back in 2010. It was titled America, the Owner's Manual, Making Government Work for You. You've got a different subtitle now. It's got
sure.
a slightly more combative tone. Do citizens need to be a little more aggressive about pursuing civic engagement?
Well, the purpose of the title isn't combat. It sort of relates to the old expression that I think, as some of the statistics we cited, a lot of Americans are feeling right now, the old expression that you can't fight City Hall. Our point in this is not to have people take up arms, but to take up the skills of effective citizenship to build and flex their citizenship muscles to engage with government and achieve the goals they want for their community. I think another reason to use City Hall in the subtitle is, and I'm biased, I come out of 4 years as chief of staff of the city of Jacksonville from 2011 to 2015, but local government offers a lot of advantages for people wanting to get engaged in their communities and get engaged with government in general. It's the level of government that probably most impacts people's lives. Here in Central Florida, whether it's the Orange County Commission or the Orlando City Hall or the Seminole County Commission, whatever the particular Orange County School Board, whatever the particular local body might be, is probably one that has the biggest impact on our day-to-day lives. They also offer some of the best opportunities for citizens to get engaged in the process and make a difference.
Chris Hand and Senator Bob Graham are the authors of America, the Owner's Manual. You can fight City Hall and win. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate it.
Still to come, the mall has been a key part of the economy for decades, but with the rise in online retail, some malls are struggling. Orlando Sentinel reporter Kyle Arnold and real estate broker John Crossman discuss the future of malls like Artagon Market and Fashion Square Mall. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. If you walked around one of the big shopping malls in Central Florida over the holidays, the Florida Mall or Millenia, you'd think business was booming. But elsewhere in the Orlando area, some malls aren't doing so well. Artagon just announced it'll shut its doors in a couple weeks. And Fashion Square Mall on Colonial Drive filed for bankruptcy, trying to stave off foreclosure. Well, joining us to talk more about the mall economy is Orlando Sentinel retail reporter Kyle Arnold. Thanks for joining us, Kyle.
Thanks.
We're also joined by John Crossman with Crossman & Company. It's a retail leasing management and investment sales firm in Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
My pleasure.
Well, Kyle, let's start off with Artagon Marketplace. What's going on with the space? I mean, it was envisaged as a kind of boutique market with independent retailers, a ropes course. What went wrong?
I don't know if anything really went wrong. It might have gone too right. It's a really lucrative piece of property there. But Festival Bay Mall was there a decade ago. It failed. It flat out failed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it might just be a case of that the property is worth more than whatever they're going to do that a traditional mall would give it.
They still have Outdoor World though, right? I mean, that's a pretty big and well patronized shop at one end of that.
Yeah. Bass Pro Shop is, you know, mm-hmm. one of those giant destination retailers, and it's looks like it's going to remain for the time being, but I can't imagine that whatever they do with this mall won't mean some change, whether they're going to tear it down and, you know, keep Bass Pro Shop there in a, mm-hmm. in a new space, or, you know, that maybe Bass Pro Shop will negotiate another deal.
John, is the Artagon concept unique? I mean, are there other places in the country where this kind of idea has worked well?
Well, any of these topics we're talking about, you're going to hear me say repeatedly is it's complicated. It's a complicated situation. And I agree with Kyle. You know, I think that location actually is strong. And just because the issue of closing doors to tenants, it doesn't mean the property is a failure. It could be that it's an evolution situation. I don't know the specifics of it, but all across the country, we're seeing similar trends with these different properties, and they're returning to more focusing on more local uses and things like that. One of the unique dynamics we have in Orlando, obviously, is the tourism factor. But no, I think it's a complicated, consistent conversation across mm-hmm. the country.
But is location important with Artagon? Well, you bring up tourists, and,
right.
and it's fairly close to iDrive. I mean, are the people in that area just looking for something that Artagon wasn't providing?
Well, I want you to keep this in mind. Orlando is the only city in the nation that has a top 10 mall and a top 10 outlet mall. Okay, so when we look at Mall Millennia, which is one of the most successful malls in America, and we look at the prime outlet malls or premium outlet malls down there, mm-hmm. yeah, that is a lot of competition. So I think that, you know, while things are strong and the market's good, it's very, very competitive. And so you can't sit back. You have to be very thoughtful about it. And maybe this is what's happening there, is somebody's got a bigger, better idea to move it forward.
Let me just quote something from an article posted on the Daily City website. Vendors apparently were told by management, quote, "The idea of the mall was amazing and that they are opening other malls across the country based on the idea." Kyle Arnold, when you hear that, I mean, does it sound like it's just a location problem?
I don't know if it's a problem at all. The mall did start out slow. It had a little trouble kind of getting some name recognition out there. People that are on the north side of the Orlando metro area, I live in Maitland. I don't travel down to the tourist sector unless I really need to, because there's a lot of stuff on the north side that'll attract me. But it was building over time, and it was getting more people, some turnover there, and they were kind of drawing some more entertaining retailers. Gods and Monsters was a really big draw,
right,
on a consistent basis there.
And I guess people who are following this story might be a little bit worried about where some of those popular stores are going to go next.
Yeah, and they're wondering the same thing right now. I've talked to quite a few that are actually out driving around today looking for new places, but mm-hmm. it'll be hard to find, you know, something in a mall like that that kind of has a given audience already.
John Crossman, are there other places where some of these shops can go, or is it going to be a tough kind of relocation for some of these places?
It's going to be tough. One thing I want to mention, I was recently at a conference, and a very large owner of malls, and I was talking to the representative, and I said, "How do you feel about the Macy's closings?"
Right.
And their response was interesting to me, because they said, "We feel great about it." And I was sort of taken aback by that, and I was like, why do you feel so great? And they're like, "Well, because we have a lot of pent-up demand, and they were able to refill the boxes quickly and actually get better rents. And it also re-energize the centers.
Okay? So it makes more sense for a mall sometimes to have multiple stores rather than a ginormous department store.
It could be, or just making sure that it's something that's more relevant and more active. To your question, though, about where they go, it's a tight market right now. It's very mm-hmm. tight. Now, it could conceivably spur on some other developments in some areas. But, you know, Disney Springs, you know, that is doing fantastic. And I love that project. I think it's one of the best retail experiences in Orlando.
Right.
And so there's more competition. So it's a tight market. Again, maybe new development or maybe another redevelopment in the area, maybe another play.
Do you know how competitive it is to get a storefront at somewhere like Disney Springs?
Oh, it's very, very competitive, very tough, very challenging situation. You better have your best A game with a pretty unique concept and a pretty unique appeal to get into a project like that. You're talking like that's one of the most premier locations in the nation. You know, again, Kyle, I think both of us being, you know, locals, you probably as well, we don't go to that area as much. So you kind of get disassociated being a local. But when you're a global company and you look at Orlando on a tourist area, it's globally looked at. So there's a lot of competitors coming in trying to do that location, and that's how they feel about it.
You have a captive audience, I guess, people coming there to Disney anyway, but I'm wondering if there's some psychology at play too. People are prepared to spend money, so they're going to be more inclined to buy stuff.
Well, think about this. First off, that people on vacation tend to spend five times as more than people that are here locally. But there's a lot of nuanced things to it as well. So let's say one of the things that department store retailers might look at is return on sales. So I go and buy this tie, I decide I don't like it, I take it back. It's not a real return. It's not a real sale. Mm-hmm. So if you're a department store, you might want to average less than 5% return on sales. When you're in the tourist corridor, they average less than 5% return on sales. So there's a quick margin differentiating being in those markets. And of course, why is there less return on sales? Because the sales are final, right? And then another thing, when you think about like high-end retail, you think about like buying, like if red is the hot color or there's some style and you're trying to buy the right amount of lots of whatever, and then in spring you're trying to sell a certain amount, hitting that is very scary, right? You have to buy the exact right amount and then sell it. And if you miss it, you can just go down really hard. I've talked to tourist retailers in our area, and they've told me they've sold the same T-shirt for 10 years. Think about if you're buying that kind of quantity, what you can do, again, that does to your margins, right? It's very significant. And then my third example is that, you know, if you were to go on vacation with your significant other and you went and stayed in a hotel for two nights, three nights someplace, would you buy a bottle of ketchup? And the answer is probably not. But if you went to a timeshare unit with your three kids and your significant other and you were there for 6 days, would you buy a bottle of ketchup? And the answer is probably yes. So if in general somebody living in an apartment somewhere in Orlando is consuming four bottles of ketchup in their apartment unit and right next to you is a timeshare unit and that timeshare unit is consuming 52 bottles of ketchup a year. So you see how quickly—
That's a lot of ketchup.
Right. And so you can see how those numbers explode very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. Impulse decisions, high margin decisions, the conventioneer traffic where people, how often do I go out and have a big steak dinner, you know, just me and my family, pretty rare. But if I have clients in town or if I'm at a convention and I'm going out and we're having a big, long business meeting, well, I'm going to spend more money on that. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of that in our community that really impacts all those numbers.
Let me come back to another mall close to the center of town, Kyle Arnold Fashion Square Mall. Now, they lost an anchor tenant, right, fairly recently?
Yeah, that's right. Just here during the holiday season, they, as a wave of store closing, Sears is going to close that. Supposedly, there were going to be some other retailers opening there, Orchard Supply Hardware, Floor and Decor. It's a little unclear if that's going to move forward as quickly with some of the other financial troubles at the mall. But there is stuff, you know, kind of waiting to replace that. But it's not the same kind of stuff that's going to maybe even bring people into the mall.
How long has Fashion Square Mall been grappling with some of these financial problems?
They've probably been grappling with it, you know, at least since it was purchased about 4 years ago. But going back, you know, a decade or more since a lot of these kind of big name tenants started to move out and close down.
Mm-hmm. And they've tried to get around that by putting some new things in there, like a boutique hotel, for example.
Yeah, that was in the plans. They got a bowling alley and a restaurant that went in there. But it just really hasn't drawn out people. And I don't know if anything's really going to change that at that mall or at any other mall.
John, when you look at Fashion Square Mall, what do you see as the biggest challenge there? Because right across the road, they have another area where they've got sort of outlet shops and the right. like, which seem to do fairly well. So what's going on with Fashion Square?
Well, I have a lot of history in this mall. I love that mall. I love the location, and I think it absolutely has everything that it could be really successful. So what's the problem? It's complicated. There's a lot of moving parts that make it challenging. Let me say this, that you know, retail worked in a very similar way for hundreds of years. And it really was, you know, post-World War II, the creation of the highway system, we had this explosion of suburbs, and malls really sort of got ramped up. And I do lectures like this with college students, and I always say that, you know, the 80s were really the zenith of the malls, and I'm an 80s kid. I'm hungry like the wolf, right? So that's really my era that it replaced that. What happened is that malls became very consistent, and consistency in retail is a powerful thing. So does McDonald's make the best cheeseburger in the world? No, my brother-in-law does, but they make a very consistent cheeseburger, and so there's value in that. So malls being consistent, that's a good thing, but they became kind of soulless, and they became kind of islands. You know, Chris Rock did a comedy bit where he talked about how malls all have all the same stuff. So once a mall becomes disconnected from its community and it becomes an island, that's when you have a problem. So I can point to malls in Orlando, Florida Mall, Altamont Mall, Mall Millennia, that are doing phenomenally well. They've connected to who their market is, and they're doing great.
And are they doing that with unique stores? A lot of them are going to have the same chains in them, right?
Yeah, but it's a combination of things. If I'm giving a lecture to business professionals in downtown Orlando, one of the things, and their CEOs, one of the things I'll say is, raise your hand if you've received some sort of personal invitation to an event at Mall Millennia. 100% of the room, the hands will go up. Because Stephen Jameson, who's the mall manager there, he knows who his target audience is, and he goes after them hard. Now, so let's talk about Fashion Square Mall. I live in Baldwin Park, right? Baldwin Park was just named by the Orlando Business Journal as the most affluent neighborhood or affluent zip code in Central Florida. You've got right. Windsong, you got that. Plus, you've got areas like Audubon Park and Thornton Park that have wonderful history. I've spoken with representatives from the city of Orlando who say that when they talk to community leaders in those areas, they all ask, what's going on with the mall? The previous owner, the current owner of Fashion Square, I met with their marketing director, and when I asked him, I said, who are you marketing to? He said East Orlando, and he did no marketing to the neighborhoods who care about the mall. That's really the problem. The demographics surrounding the mall, if the people around there went into it, it'd be great. It would be a fantastic property. When you talk to people in Baldwin Park, Windsong, Audubon, Thorpe Park, they're going to Altamont, and they're going to Mall Millennia, driving right past that property. So the bones are there to cure it, but it's got to figure out how to pierce the culture. So is that retailers? Yes. But it's also events. It's also marketing. It's also community connectivity and making it back to being kind of like a town center. And I don't mean that town center architecturally, although that could be part of it. I mean town center in the heart of it, the feel of it, that it's connected to the community.
Let me bring that back to you, Kyle Arnold, and just picking up on this idea of events. I mean, I do notice that they have the Daily City Food Truck Roundup there. Is that the kind of thing that's going to help this mall succeed, do you think, or survive?
A lot of malls have tried it. Artagon was attempting a similar thing. It was really hard to say. There are malls doing very well in Orlando, and the ones that are doing well, Florida Mall, Mall at Millennia, they have a, you know, a really strategic advantage in the tourism sector. Altamont Mall is doing well too, and they don't need the kind of events and those kind of things to survive.
Is there, though, an audience for folks who don't want to drive out to the suburbs? I mean, people who might want to be coming back into the city and ditching their car.
There's a future for the mall. I just don't know if the future will be as a mall as we know it.
But let me jump in and say this. In the past, when you were developing malls, malls often put the anchor tenants would have restrictions on how much restaurants you could put in or where you put the restaurants in because they were so concerned about parking. There are now national department store retailers who are going in malls saying in their leases, you must put 3 sit-down restaurants in close proximity to me. So when you're talking about food trucks, like I'm like, yeah, but that's not a fix to it. Like when I think of Altamont Mall does have restaurants in close proximity connected to it. And other malls that are doing well have that. Fashion Square Mall has Panera, and that's it. It doesn't have any kind of restaurant feel to it. So you know, one of the things I would say that a cure to that mall would be adding 4 or 5 restaurants on property.
I mean, there are restaurants close to it.
Right, but there's no connectivity point to it. I was at Meisner Park last 2 nights at a convention, and so I had dinner both nights at Meisner, and like there's a movie theater there, and you can eat, and you get the food delivered to you in the theater, things like that. So that's desperately missing there at Fashion Square.
Further out from Orlando, there are other places where they seem to be developing new malls, for example, out in Daytona Beach, the Tanger Outlets Mall. Is an outlet mall a different beast altogether from
totally,
a regular mall?
Totally different. Not different planets. Mm-hmm. You know, the outlet world is a very specific world. Those retailers all work together, and they don't ever leave that. So it's a different kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Can I mention just a quick, just a big picture thing? By our DNA, we need to connect with people. So I think that, you know, developments that learn how to well connect people and people feel connected to it, that is a key component to its survival. So it needs to be strategic, and whatever strategic that means. I actually think West Oaks Mall is doing some cool stuff, and they're evolving, and they're looking at adding multifamily and putting office uses in, which, again, that was unheard of, you know, 10 years ago. But it's a great use to add to a mall now. Like, if I was Hailing Fashion Square Mall, I would try to add as much medical and office into that project as possible. Because what it does, partly it takes some of the retail off, right? So it increases, you know, the demand by improving some of the supply. But it also adds shoppers when there's typically not shoppers. We've seen all across the country, we've seen grocery stores added to malls, education, medical, religious. All these different kind of categories have all been part of that as far as we've seen malls really figure it out. But let me tell you, all of it's complicated. When I was doing work with Fashion Square, again, before this ownership, I remember talking to that marketing director and saying, why don't you have a Facebook page? They had no social media presence like 6 years ago. That's a pretty big deal for that demographic, right? A mall shopper and social media. They were way, way, way late in that game.
Has that changed at all, Kyle Arnold?
They're online a little bit. Artagon was one of the ones that was very aggressive in their social media and their marketing.
And did that work? I mean, talking about building a relationship with customers, was that you were saying that that was kind of catching on?
It did seem to kind of get their message across. Again, it was a location that was hard for a lot of local people to get to. You know, there were some market factors in there.
If you're looking at a place like Artagon, you're saying it's a property that, if it's not a mall, it's valuable for other reasons, or even Fashion Square. What are people saying could go in there in this place?
Well, a lot of these open-air developments, if you've ever been to Winter Park Village, I was there last week with my wife. There are a ton of restaurants there. There's a movie theater. There's a Publix. There were actually very few retailers. There are a handful in there. But these are these internet-proof businesses. That's one of the words that's going around in the real estate world.
Right.
You still want to go out for that dining experience, and they want to put in places that you can't replicate online.
That comes back to the idea of community, or a place you actually want to spend some time and walk around.
Exactly. Two things to think about. One is, and I like this as a thought, you know, when you're looking at big and mall projects, one of the things we haven't talked about but you need to, everybody think about, is having access to capital. You're either going to get a loan or you get an institutional investment. If you're going to big money and asking to invest millions of dollars into your retail project, you better be prepared to be able to explain the story of why this project is going to hold up in the face of our e-commerce, you know, system we're in now. And so to Kyle's point, you're exactly right. So you better have that plan in place how to balance against that. Now, you know, I talked about, you know, one of the things about us as people, my Floral Hospital example, is community. So retail is still extremely relevant, but it's going to be different, and it may not be as much soft good retail. It may be, to Kyle's point, maybe restaurant and experiential. I think it's funny, as a good example, Office Depot has a new format they're doing that's smaller. And in that smaller format, they've got some space where people can make copies but then talk to each other. It's kind of like a little bit of a Starbucks, you know, that kind of concept. That's smart, you know. Or think about like Taco Bell, and their app program has done phenomenally well in how their experience with customers. So it can happen all kinds of ways, but you got to think that through. The other thing I wanted to mention to you is this, is that if you study the history of America, when they first gridded out the country and they had section township range, all of that was basically being about 2 to 2.5 miles. When the settlements started moving west and they do cities, they were about 2 miles apart. There was that concept. My brother has done church planting in Bolivia in the last few years, and when he plants churches in Bolivia, they're 2 miles apart. If you ask Publix about the recent expansion of Virginia and ask, hey, just rule of thumb, how far about those Publix is? About 2 miles apart. Now think about what I just said. I just covered 300 years of history, and yet that scale really hasn't changed.
John Crossman is a real estate broker with Crossman & Company. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we're also joined by Kyle Arnold. He's a retail reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Talia Blake. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening. ¶¶